doing, that sort of thing. Would you call them inquisitive types? Yes, Siri said. I guess. I mean, as much as anybody. Maybe more. Were there ever any murders in your village? A couple, Siri said, glancing down. There shouldn't have been. My father always said things like that shouldn't happen in Idris. Said murder was a thing of, well, Halandrin. Lightsong chuckled. Yes, we do it all the time. Quite the party trick. Now, did these policemen investigate the murders? Of course. Without having to be asked to do so? Siri nodded. How'd they go about it? I don't know, Siri said. They asked questions, talked to witnesses, looked for clues. I wasn't involved. No, no, Lightsong said. Of course you weren't. Why, if you'd been a murderer, they would have done something terrible to you, yes? Like exile you to another country. Siri felt herself pale, hair growing lighter. Lightsong just laughed. Don't go taking me so seriously, Your Majesty. Honestly, I gave up wondering if you were an assassin days ago. Now, if your servants and mine will stay behind for a second, I think I may have something important to tell you. Siri started as Lightsong stood up. He began to walk from the pavilion, and his servants remained where they were. Confused but excited, Siri rose from her own seat and hurried after him. She caught up with him a short distance away, on the stone walkway that ran between the various boxes in the arena. Down below, the athletes continued their display. Lightsong looked down at her, smiling. They really are tall, she thought, craning a bit. A single foot of extra height made such a difference. Standing next to a man like Lightsong, and not really being that tall herself, she felt dwarfed. Maybe he'll tell me the thing I've been looking for, Siri thought. The secret. You are playing a dangerous game, my queen, Lightsong said, leaning against the stone railing. It was built for returned proportions, so it was too high for her to rest against comfortably. Game? She asked. Politics, he said, watching the athletes. I don't want to play politics. If you don't, it will play you, I'm afraid. I always get sucked in, regardless of what I do. Complaining doesn't stop that, though it does annoy people, which is satisfying in its own right. Siri frowned. So you pulled me aside to give me a warning? Colors, no, Lightsong said, chuckling. If you haven't already figured out that this is dangerous, then you're far too dense to appreciate a warning. I just wanted to give you some advice. The first is about your persona.
My persona?
Yes, he said. It needs work. Choosing the persona of an innocent newcomer was a good instinct. It suits you. But you need to refine it. Work on it.
It's not a persona, she said sincerely. I am confused and new to all this.
Lightsong raised a finger.
That's the trick to politics, child. Sometimes, although you can't disguise who you are and how you really feel, you can make use of who you are. People distrust that which they can't understand and predict. As long as you feel like an unpredictable element in court, you will appear to be a threat. If you can skillfully and honestly portray yourself as someone they understand, then you'll begin to fit in.
Siri frowned. Take me as an example, Lightsong said. I'm a useless fool. I always have been, as long as I can remember, which actually isn't all that long. Anyway, I know how people regard me. I enhance it, play with it.
So it's a lie?
Of course not. This is who I am. However, I make certain that people never forget it.
You can't control everything. But if you can control how people regard you, then you can find a place in this mess. And once you have that, you can begin to influence factions. Should you want to. I rarely do, because it's such a bother. Ciri cocked her head. Then she smiled. You're a good man, Lightsong, she said. I knew it. Even when you were insulting me. You mean no harm. Is that part of your persona? Of course, he said, smiling. But I'm not sure what it is that convinces people to trust me. I'd get rid of it if I could. It only serves to make people expect too much. Just give what I said some practice. The best thing about being locked in this beautiful prison is that you can do some good. You can change things. I've seen others do it, people I respected, even if there haven't been many of those around the court lately. All right, she said. I will. You're digging for something. I can sense it. And it has to do with the priests. Don't make too many waves until you're ready to strike. Sudden and surprising, that's how you want to be. You don't want to appear too non-threatening. People are always suspicious of the innocent. The trick is to appear average, just as crafty as everyone else. That way, everyone else will assume that they can beat you with just a little advantage. Ciri nodded. Kind of an Idrian philosophy. You came from us, Lightsong said, or perhaps we came from you. Either way, we're more similar than our outward trappings make us seem. What is that Idrian philosophy of extreme plainness, except a means of contrasting with Halandrin? All those whites you people use. That makes you stand out on a national scale. You act like us. We act like you. We just do the same things in opposite ways. She nodded slowly. He smiled. Oh, and one thing. Please, please, don't depend on me too much. I mean that. I'm not going to be of much help. If your plots come to a head, if things go wrong at the last moment and you're in danger or distress, don't think of me. I will fail you. That, I promise from my heart with absolute sincerity. You're a very strange man. Product of my society, he said. And since most of the time my society consists pretty much only of myself, I blame God. Good day, my queen. With that, he sauntered off back to his box and waved for her servants, who had been watching with concern, to finally rejoin her. Chapter 28. The meeting is set, my lady, Thame said. The men are eager. Your work in Tateller is gaining more and more notoriety. Vivenna wasn't sure what she thought of that. She sipped her juice. The lukewarm liquid was addictively flavorful, although she wished for some Idrian ice. Thame looked at her eagerly. The short Idrian was, according to Denth's investigations, trustworthy enough. His story of being forced into a life of crime was a tad overstated. He filled a niche in Halandrin society. He acted as a liaison between the Idrian workers and the various criminal elements. He was also, apparently, a staunch patriot. Despite the fact that he tended to exploit his own people, particularly newcomers, to the city. How many will be at the meeting? Vivenna asked, watching traffic pass on the street out beyond the restaurant's patio gate. Over 100, my lady, Thame said. Loyal to our king, I promise. And they're influential men, all of them, for Idrians in Tateller, that is. Which, according to Denth, meant that they were men who wielded power in the city because they could provide cheap Idrian workers and could sway the opinion of the underprivileged Idrian masses. They were men who, like Thame, thrived because of the Idrian expatriates. A strange duality. These men had stature among an oppressed minority, and without the oppression, they would be powerless. Like Lemix, she thought, who served my father, even seemed to respect and love him, all the while stealing every bit of gold he could lay his hands on. She leaned back, wearing a white dress with a long pleated skirt that rippled and blew in the wind. She tapped the side of her cup, which caused a serving man to refill her juice. Thame smiled, taking more juice as well, though he looked out of place in the fine restaurant. "How many are there, you suppose?" she asked. "Idrians in the city, I mean."
"Perhaps as many as 10,000.
"That many?"
"Trouble on the lower farms," Thame said, shrugging. "It's hard, sometimes, living up in those mountains. Crops fail, and what do you have? The king owns your land, so you can't sell. You need to pay your levies."
"Yes, but one can petition in the case of disaster," Vivenna said.
"Ah, my lady, but most of these men are several weeks' travel from the king. Should they leave their families to make a petition, when they fear their loved ones will starve during the weeks it will take to bring food from the king's storehouse, if they are successful? Or do they travel the much shorter distance down to Teteller? Take work there, loading on the docks or harvesting flowers in the jungle plantations. It's hard work, but steady."
"And in doing so, they betray their people." But who was she to judge? The fifth vision would define it as haughtiness. Here she sat in the cool shade of a canopy, enjoying a nice breeze and expensive juice, while other men slaved to provide for their families. She had no right to sneer at their motivations. Idrians shouldn't have to seek for work in Halandrin. She didn't like to admit fault in her father, yet his wasn't a bureaucratically efficient kingdom. It consisted of dozens of scattered villages with poor highways that were often blocked by snows or rock slides. In addition, he was forced to expend a lot of resources keeping his army strong in case of a Halandrin assault. He had a difficult job. Was that a good enough excuse for the poverty of her people who had been forced to flee their homeland? The more she listened and learned, the more she realized that many Idrians had never known anything like the idyllic life she'd lived in her lovely mountain valley.
"The meeting is 3 days hence, my lady," Thame said. "Some of these men are hesitant after Var and his failure, but they will listen to you."
"I will be there."
"Thank you."
Thame rose, bowed, despite the fact that she'd asked him not to draw attention to her, and withdrew. Vivenna sat and sipped her juice. She felt Denth before he arrived.
"You know what interests me," he said, taking the seat Thame had been using.
"What?"
"People," he said, tapping an empty cup, drawing the serving man back over. "People interest me, particularly people who don't act like they're supposed to. People who surprise me."
"I hope you aren't talking about Thame," Vivenna asked, raising an eyebrow. Denth shook his head.
"I'm talking about you, princess. Wasn't too long ago that, no matter what or who you looked at, you had a look of quiet displeasure in your eyes. You've lost it. You're starting to fit in."
"Then that's a problem, Denth," Vivenna said. "I don't want to fit in. I hate Halandrin."
"You seem to like that juice, all right."
Vivenna set it aside. "You're right, of course. I shouldn't be drinking it."
"If you say so," Denth said, shrugging. "Now, if you were to ask the mercenary, which, of course, nobody ever does, he might mention that it's good for you to start acting like a Halandrin. The less you stand out, the less likely people are to connect you to that Idrian princess hiding in the city. Take your friend Parlin."
"He looks like a fool in those bright colors," she said, glancing across the street toward where he and Jules were chatting as they watched the escape route.
"Does he?" Denth said. "Or does he just look like a Halandrin?" Would you hesitate at all if you were in the jungle and saw him put on the fur of a beast, or perhaps shroud himself in a cloak colored like fallen leaves? She looked again. Parlin lounged against the side of a building, much like street toughs his age she'd seen elsewhere in the city.
You both fit better here than you once did, Dent said. You're learning.
Vivenna looked down. Some things in her new life were actually starting to feel natural. The raids, for instance, were becoming surprisingly easy. She was also growing used to moving with the crowds and being part of an underground element. 2 months earlier, she would have been indignantly opposed to dealing with a man like Denth, simply because of his profession. She found it very difficult to reconcile herself to some of these changes. It was growing harder and harder to understand herself and to decide what she believed.
Though, Denth said, eyeing Vivenna's dress, you might want to think about switching to trousers.
Vivenna frowned, looking up.
Just a suggestion, Dent said, then gulped down some juice. You don't like the short Halandrin skirts, but the only decent clothing we can buy you that are modest are of foreign make, and that makes them expensive. That means we have to use expensive restaurants, lest we stand out. That means you have to deal with all of this terrible lavishness. Trousers, however, are modest and cheap.
Trousers are not modest.
Don't show knees, he said.
Doesn't matter.
Denth shrugged.
Just giving my opinion.
Vivenna looked away, then sighed quietly.
I appreciate the advice, Denth. Really. I'm confused by a lot of my life lately.
World's a confusing place, Denth said. That's what makes it fun.
The men we're working with, Vivenna said. They lead the Idrians in the city, but exploit them at the same time. Lemek stole from my father, but still worked for the interests of my country. And here I am, wearing an overpriced dress and sipping expensive juice, while my sister is being abused by an awful dictator, and while this wonderful, terrible city prepares to launch a war on my homeland.
Denth leaned back in his chair, looking out over the short railing toward the street, watching the crowds with their colors both beautiful and terrible.
The motivations of men, they never make sense. And they always make sense.
Right now, you don't make sense.
Denth smiled.
What I'm trying to say is that you don't understand a man until you understand what makes him do what he does. Every man is a hero in his own story, Princess. Murderers don't believe that they're to blame for what they do. Thieves, they think they deserve the money they take. Dictators, they believe they have the right, for the safety of their people and the good of the nation, to do whatever they wish.
He stared off, shaking his head.
I think even Vasher sees himself as a hero. The truth is, most people who do what you'd call wrong do it for what they call right reasons. Only mercenaries make any sense. We do what we're paid to do. That's it. Perhaps that's why people look down on us so. We're the only ones who don't pretend to have higher motives.
He paused, then met her eyes.
In a way, we're the most honest men you'll ever meet.
The two of them fell silent, the crowd passing by just a short distance away, a river of flashing colors. Another figure approached the table.
That's right, Tonk Fa said. But you forgot to mention that in addition to being honest, we're also clever and handsome.
Those both go without saying, Dent said.
Vivenna turned. Tonk Fa had been watching from nearby, ready to provide backup. They were letting her start to take the lead in some of the meetings.
Honest, perhaps, Vivenna said, but I certainly hope that you're not the most handsome men I'll ever meet. Are we ready to go?
Assuming you're finished with your juice,
Dent said, smirking at her. Vivenna glanced at her cup. It was very good. Feeling guilty, she drained the juice. It would be a sin to waste it, she thought. Then she rose and swished her way from the building, leaving Denth, who now handled most of the coins, to settle the bill. Outside on the street, they were joined by Claude, who'd been given orders to come if she screamed for help. She turned, looking back at Tonk Fa and Denth. Tonks, she said, where's your monkey? He sighed.
Monkeys are boring anyway.
She rolled her eyes. You lost another one?
Denth chuckled. Get used to it, princess. Of all the happy miracles in the universe, one of the greatest is that Tonks has never fathered a child. He'd probably lose it before the week was out.
She shook her head. You may be right, she said. Next appointment. The Denier Garden, right?
Denth nodded.
Let's go, she said, walking down the street. The others trailed behind, picking up Parlin and Jules on the way. Vivenna didn't wait for Claude to force a way through the crowd. The less she depended on that lifeless, the better. Moving through the streets really wasn't that difficult. There was an art to it. One moved with a crowd, rather than trying to swim against its flow. It wasn't long before Vivenna, at the front, the group turned off into the wide grassy field that was the Dedenier Garden. Like the crossroads square, this place was an open space of green life set among the buildings and colors. Yet, here no flowers or trees broke the landscape, nor did people bustle about. This was a more reverent place. And it was filled with statues, hundreds of them. They looked much like the other Dedenir in the city, with their oversized bodies and heroic poses, many tied with colorful cloths or garments. These were some of the oldest statues she had seen, their stone weathered from years spent enduring the frequent Teteller rainfalls. This group was the final gift from Peacegiver the Blessed. The statues had been made as a memorial to those who had died in the Many War, a monument and a warning, so the legends said. Vivenna couldn't help thinking that if the people really did honor those who had fallen, they wouldn't dress the statues up in such ridiculous costumes. Still, the place was far more serene than most in Teteller, and she could appreciate that. She walked down the steps onto the lawn, wandering between the silent stone figures. Denth moved up beside her.
Remember who we're meeting?
She nodded. Forgers.
Denth eyed her. You all right with this?
Denth, during our months together, I've met with thief lords, murderers, and, most frighteningly, mercenaries. I think I can deal with a couple of spindly scribes.
Denth shook his head. These are the men who sell the documents, not the scribes who do the work. You won't meet more dangerous men than forgers. Within the Halandrin bureaucracy, they can make anything seem legal by putting the right documents in the right places.
Vivenna nodded slowly.
You remember what to have them make?
Denth asked. Of course I do, she said. This particular plan was my idea, remember?
Just checking, he said.
You're worried that I'll mess things up, aren't you?
He shrugged. You're the leader in this little dance, princess. I'm just the guy who mops the floor afterward.
He eyed her.
I hate mopping up blood.
Oh, please, she said, rolling her eyes, walking faster and leaving him behind. As he fell back, she could hear him talking to Tonk Fa.
Bad metaphor? Denth asked.
Nah, Tonk Fa said. It had blood in it. That makes it a good metaphor.
I think it lacked poetic style.
Find something that rhymes with blood, then,
Tonk Fa suggested. He paused.
Mud? Thud? Taste bud?
They sure are literate, for a bunch of thugs,
she thought. She didn't have to go far before she spotted the men. They waited beside the agreed meeting place, a large dedenier with a weathered axe. The group of people were having a picnic and chatting among themselves, a picture of harmless innocence. Vivenna slowed.
That's them, Denth whispered. Let's go sit beside the dedenier across from them.
Jules, Claude, and Parlin hung back, while Tonk Fa strolled away to watch the perimeter. Vivenna and Denth approached the statue near the forgers. Denth spread out a blanket for her, then stood to the side, as if he were a manservant. One of the men beside the other statue looked across as Vivenna sat down. Then he nodded. The others continued to eat. The Halandrin Underground's penchant for working in broad daylight still unnerved Vivenna, but she supposed it had advantages over skulking about at night.
You want some work commissioned?
The forger closest to her asked, just loudly enough that Vivenna could hear. It almost seemed part of his conversation with his friends.
Yes,
she said.
It costs.
I can pay.
You're the princess everyone is talking about?
She paused, noticing Dent's hand leisurely going to his sword hilt.
Yes,
she said.
Good,
the forger said.
Royalty always seems to know how to handle itself.
What is it you desire?
Letters, Vivenna said. I want them to appear as if they were between certain members of the Halandrin priesthood and the King of Idris. They need to have official seals and convincing signatures.
Difficult,
the man said. Vivenna pulled something from her dress pocket.
I have a letter written in King Dedelan's hand. It has his seal on the wax, his signature at the bottom.
The man seemed intrigued, though she could only see the side of his face.
That makes it possible. Still hard. What do you want these documents to prove?
That these particular priests are corrupt, Vivenna said. I have a list on this sheet. I want you to make it look like they've been extorting Idris for years, forcing our king to pay outrageous sums and make extreme promises in order to prevent war. I want you to show that Idris doesn't want war and that the priests are hypocrites.
The man nodded.
Is that everything?
Yes.
It can be done. We'll be in touch. Instructions and explanations are on the back of the paper.
As requested, Vivenna said.
The group of men stood, a servant moving forward to pack up their lunch. As he did so, he let a napkin blow in the wind, then rushed over and picked it up, grabbing Vivenna's paper, too. Soon, all of them were gone.
Well?
Vivenna asked, looking up.
Good,
Denth said, nodding to himself. You're becoming an expert. Vivenna smiled, settling back on her blanket to wait. The next appointment consisted of a group of thieves who had stolen, at Vivenna and Denth's request, various goods from the war offices in the Halandrin bureaucratic building. The documents were of relatively little import themselves, but their absence would cause confusion and frustration. That appointment wasn't for a few hours, which meant she could enjoy some time relaxing on the lawn, away from the unnatural colors of the city. Denth seemed to sense her inclination, and he sat down, leaning back against the side of the statue's bare pedestal. As Vivenna waited, she saw that Parlin was over talking to Jules again. Denth was right. Though his clothing looked ridiculous to her, it was because she knew him as an Idrian. Looking at him more objectively, she saw that he fit in remarkably well with other young men in the city.
That's well and good for him,
Vivenna thought with annoyance, looking away.
He can dress as he wishes. He doesn't have to worry about his neckline or hemline.
Jules laughed. It was almost a snort of derision, but there was some mirth in it.
Vivenna looked back immediately, watching Jules roll her eyes at Parlin, who had a self-effacing smirk on his face. He knew he'd said something wrong. He didn't know what. Vivenna knew him well enough to read the expression and to know that he'd just smile and go along with it. Jules saw his face, then laughed again. Vivenna gritted her teeth. "I should send him back to Idris," she said. Denth turned, looking down at her. "Hmm?"
"Parlin," she said. "I sent my other guides back. I should have sent him too. He serves no function."
"He's quick at adapting to situations," Denth said, "and he's trustworthy. That's good enough reason to keep him."
"He's a fool," Vivenna said. "Has trouble understanding half of what goes on around him."
"He's not the wit of a scholar, true, but he seems to instinctively know how to blend in. Besides, we can't all be geniuses like you."
She glanced at Denth. "What does that mean?"
"It means," Denth said, "that you shouldn't let your hair change colors in public, princess."
Vivenna started, noticing that her hair had shifted from a still, calm black to the red of frustration.
"Lord of colors," she thought. "I used to be so good at controlling that. What is happening to me?"
"Don't worry," Denth said, settling back. "Jules has no interest in your friend. I promise you."
Vivenna snorted.
"Parlin? Why should I care?"
"Oh, I don't know," Denth said. "Maybe because you and he have been practically engaged since you were children."
"That's completely untrue," Vivenna said. "I've been engaged to the God King since before my birth."
"And your father always wished you could marry the son of his best friend instead," Denth said. "At least, that's what Parlin says."
He eyed her with a smirk.
"That boy talks too much."
"Actually, he's usually rather quiet," Denth said. "You have to pry to get him to talk about himself. Either way, Jules has other ties. So stop your worrying."
"I'm not worried," Vivenna said, "and I'm not interested in Parlin."
"Of course not."
Vivenna opened her mouth to object, but she noticed Tonk Fa wandering over and didn't want him to join this discussion as well. She snapped her jaw shut as the hefty mercenary arrived.
"Flood,"
Tonk Fa said.
"Hm?"
Denth asked.
"Rhymes with blood,"
Tonk Fa said.
"Now you can be poetic. Flood of blood. It is a nice visual image. Far better than taste bud."
"Ah, I see,"
Denth said flatly.
"Tonk Fa?"
"Yes?"
"You're an idiot."
"Thanks."
Vivenna stood up and began to walk through the statues, studying them, if only to escape having to watch Parlin and Jules. Tonk Fa and Denth trailed along behind at a comfortable distance, keeping a watchful eye. There was a beauty to the statues. They weren't like the other kinds of art in Teteller: flashy paintings, colorful buildings, exaggerated clothing. The Dedenir were solid blocks that had aged with dignity. The Halandrin, of course, did their best to destroy this with the scarves, hats, or other colorful bits they tied on the stone memorials. Fortunately, there were too many in this garden for all to be decorated. They stood as if on guard, somehow more solid than much of the city. Most stared up into the sky or looked straight ahead. Each one was different, each pose distinct, each face unique. "It must have taken decades to create all of these," she thought. "Perhaps that's where the Halandrin got their penchant for art." Halandrin was such a place of contradictions. Warriors to represent peace. Idrians who exploited and protected each other at the same time. Mercenaries who seemed to be among the best men she had ever known. Bright colors that created a kind of uniformity. And over it all, biochromatic breath. It was exploitive, Yet people like Jules saw giving up their breath as a privilege.
Contradictions.
The question was, could Vivenna afford to become another contradiction? A person who bent her beliefs in order to see that they were preserved? The breaths were wonderful. It was more than just the beauty or the ability to hear changes in sound and sense intrinsically the distinct hues of color. It was more even than the ability to sense life around her, more than the sounds of the wind and the tones of people talking, or her ability to feel her way through a group of people and move easily with the motions of a crowd. It was a connection. The world around her felt close. Even inanimate things like her clothing or fallen twigs felt near to her. They were dead, yet seemed to yearn for life again. She could give it to them. They remembered life, and she could awaken those memories. But what good would it do to save her people if she lost herself? Denth doesn't seem lost, she thought. He and the other mercenaries can separate what they believe from what they are forced to do. In her opinion, that was why people regarded mercenaries as they did. If you divorced your belief from action, then you were on dangerous ground. No, she thought, no awakening for me. The breath would remain untapped. If it tempted her too much further, she would give the lot away to somebody who had none and become a drab herself. Chapter 29.
Tell me about the mountains,
Sesebron wrote. Ciri smiled. Mountains?
Please,
he wrote, sitting in his chair beside the bed. Ciri lay on one side. Her bulky dress had been too hot for this evening, so she sat in her shift with a sheet over her, resting on one elbow so she could see what he wrote. The fire crackled.
I don't know what to tell you, she said.
I mean, the mountains aren't amazing, like the wonders you have in Teteller. You have so many colors, so much variety.
I think that rocks sticking from the ground and rising thousands of feet into the air count as a wonder,
he wrote. I guess, she said. I liked it in Idris. I didn't want to know anything else. For someone like you, though, it would probably be boring.
More boring than sitting in the same palace every day, not allowed to leave, not allowed to speak, being dressed and pampered?
Okay, you win.
Tell me of them, please.
His handwriting was getting very good. Plus, the more he wrote, the more he seemed to understand. She wished so much that she could find him books to read. She suspected that he'd absorb them quickly, becoming as learned as any of the scholars who had tried to tutor her. And yet, all he had was Ciri. He seemed to appreciate what she gave him, but that was probably only because he didn't know just how ignorant she was. I suspect, she thought, that my tutors would laugh themselves silly if they knew how much I'd come to regret ignoring them. The mountains are vast, she said. You can't really get a sense of it here in the lowlands. It's by seeing them that you know just how insignificant people really are. I mean, no matter how long we worked and built, we could never pile up anything as high as one of the mountains. They're rocks, like you said, but they're not lifeless. They're green as your jungles, but it's a different green. I heard some of the traveling merchants complain that the mountains cut off their view, but I think you can see more. They let you see the surface of the land as it extends upward, toward Ostra's domain in the sky. He paused.
Ostra?
Ciri flushed, hair blushing as well. I'm sorry. I probably shouldn't talk about other gods in front of you.
Other gods?
He wrote.
Like those in the court?
No, Ciri said. Astra is the Idrian god.
I understand,
Sesebron wrote.
Is he very handsome?
Ciri laughed. No, you don't understand. He's not a returned, like you or Lightsong. He's, well, I don't know. Didn't the priests mention other religions to you?
Other religions?
He wrote. Sure, she said. I mean, not everybody worships the returned. The Idrians, like me, worship Ostra, and the Pankal people, like Bluefingers. Well, I don't actually know what they worship, but it's not you.
That is very strange to consider, he wrote. If your gods are not returned, then what are they?
Not they, Ciri said. Just one. We call him Ostra. The Halandrin used to worship him, too, before... She almost said before they became heretics. Before Peacegiver arrived, and they decided to worship the Returned instead.
But who is this Ostra?
He wrote. He's not a person, Ciri said. He's more of a force. You know, the thing that watches over all people, who punishes those who don't do what is right, and who blesses those who are worthy.
Have you met this creature?
Ciri laughed. Of course not. You can't see Ostra. Sesebron frowned, looking at her. I know, she said. It must seem silly to you. But, well, we know he's there. When I see something beautiful in nature, when I look at the mountains, with their wildflowers growing in patterns that are somehow more right than a man could have planted, I know. Beauty is real. That's what reminds me of Ostra. Plus, we've got the returned, including the first returned, Vo. He had the 5 visions before he died, and they must have come from somewhere.
But you don't believe in worshipping the returned.
Ciri shrugged. I haven't decided yet. My people teach strongly against it. They're not fond of the way that the Halandrin understand religion. He sat quietly for a long moment.
So, you do not like those such as me?
What? Of course I like you. You're sweet. He frowned, writing,
I don't think God kings are supposed to be sweet.
Fine, then, she said, rolling her eyes. You're terrible and mighty, awesome and deific, and sweet.
Much better,
he wrote, smiling.
I should very much like to meet this Ostra.
I'll introduce you to some monks sometime, Ciri said. They should be able to help you with that.
Now you are mocking me.
Ciri smiled as he looked up at her. There was no hurt in his eyes. He didn't appear to mind being mocked. Indeed, he seemed to find it very interesting. He particularly liked trying to pick out when she was being serious and when she wasn't. He looked down again.
More than meeting with this god, however, I should like to see the mountains. You seem to love them very much.
I do, Ciri said. It had been a long time since she'd thought of Idris. But as he mentioned it, she remembered the cool, open feeling of the meadows she had run through not so long ago. The crispness of the chilly air, something that she suspected one could never find in Halandrin. Plants in the Court of Gods were kept perfectly clipped, cultivated, and arranged. They were beautiful. But the wild fields of her homeland had their own special feel. Sesebron was writing again.
I suspect that the mountains are beautiful, as you have said. However, I believe the most beautiful thing in them has already come down to me.
Ciri started, then flushed. He seemed so open, not even a little embarrassed or shy about the bold compliment. "Sesebron," she said, "you have the heart of a charmer."
"Charmer?"
he wrote.
"I must only speak what I see. There is nothing so wonderful as you, even in my entire court. The mountains must be special indeed to produce such beauty."
"See, now you've gone too far," she said. "I've seen the goddesses of your court. They're far more beautiful than I am."
"Beauty is not about how a person looks,"
Sesebron wrote.
"My mother taught me this. The travelers in my storybook must not judge the old woman ugly, for she might be a beautiful goddess inside."
"This isn't a story," Sesebron.
"Yes, it is," he wrote. "All of those stories are just tales told by people who lived lives before ours. What they say about humankind is true. I have watched and seen how people act."
He erased, then continued.
"It is strange for me to interpret these things, for I do not see as normal men do. I am the God King. Everything, to my eyes, has the same beauty."
Ciri frowned. "I don't understand."
"I have thousands of breaths," he wrote. "It is hard to see as other people do. Only through the stories of my mother can I understand their ways. All colors are beauty in my eyes. When others look at something, a person, one may sometimes seem more beautiful than another. This is not so for me. I see only the color, the rich, wondrous colors that make up all things and give them life. I cannot focus only on the face, as so many do. I see the sparkle of the eyes, the blush of the cheeks, the tones of skin. Even each blemish is a distinct pattern. All people are wonderful."
He erased.
"And so, when I speak of beauty, I must speak of things other than these colors. And you are different. I do not know how to describe it."
He looked up. And suddenly Ciri was aware of just how close they were to each other. She, only in her shift, with a thin sheet covering her. He, tall and broad, shining with a soul that made the colors of the sheets bend out like light through a prism. He smiled in the firelight.
"Oh dear," she thought, "this is dangerous."
She cleared her throat, sitting up, flushing yet again.
"Well, yes. Very nice. Thank you."
He looked back down.
"I wish I could let you go home to see your mountains again. Perhaps I could explain this to the priests."
She paled. "I don't think it would be good to let them know that you can read."
"I could use the artisan's script. It is very difficult to write, but they taught it to me so I could communicate with them if I needed to."
"Still," she said, "telling them you want to send me home could hint that you've been talking to me." He stopped writing for a few moments.
"Maybe that would be a good thing,"
he wrote. "Sesebron, they're planning to kill you."
"You have no proof of that."
"Well, it's suspicious, at least," she said.
The last two God Kings died within months of producing an heir. You're too untrusting, Sesebron wrote. I keep telling you, my priests are good people.
She regarded him flatly, catching his eyes.
Except for removing my tongue, he admitted.
And keeping you locked up, and not telling you anything. Look, even if they aren't planning to kill you, they know things they're not telling you. Perhaps it's something to do with biochroma, something that makes you die once your heir arrives.
She frowned, leaning back. Could that be it? She wondered suddenly.
Sesebron, how do you pass on your breaths?
He paused.
I don't know, he wrote. I don't know a lot about it.
I don't either, she said. Can they take them from you? Give them to your son? What if that kills you?
They wouldn't do that, he wrote.
But maybe it's possible, she said, and maybe that's what happens. That's why having a child is so dangerous. They have to make a new God King, and it kills you to do so.
He sat with his board on his lap, then shook his head, writing,
I am a god. I am not given breaths. I am born with them.
No, Ciri said. Bluefingers told me you'd been collecting them for centuries, that each God King gets 2 breaths a week instead of 1, building up his reserves.
Actually, he admitted, some weeks I get 3 or 4.
But you only need 1 a week to survive.
Yes.
And they can't let that wealth die with you. They're too afraid of it to let you use it, but they also can't let themselves lose it. So, when a new child is born, they take the breath from the old king, killing him, and give it to the new one.
But returned cannot use their breath for awakening, he wrote. So my treasure of breaths is useless.
This gave her pause. She had heard that. Does that mean only the breath you're born with? Or does it include the extra breaths that have been added on top?
I do not know, he wrote.
I'll bet you could use those extra breaths if you wanted, she said. Otherwise, why remove your tongue? You may not be able to access and use that breath that makes you returned in the first place, but you have thousands and thousands of breaths above that.
Sesebron sat for a few moments, and then finally he rose, walking across to the window. He stared out at the darkness beyond. Ciri frowned, then picked up his board and crossed the room. She got off the bed and approached hesitantly, wearing only her shift.
Sesebron, she asked.
He continued to stare out the window. She joined him, careful not to touch him, looking out. Colorful lights sparkled amidst the city beyond the wall of the Court of Gods. Beyond that was darkness, the still sea.
Please, she said, pushing the board into his hands. What is it?
He paused, then took it.
I am sorry, he wrote. I do not wish to appear petulant.
Is it because I keep challenging your priests?
No,
he wrote.
You have interesting theories, but I think they are just guesses. You do not know that the priests plan what you claim. That doesn't bother me.
What is it, then?
He hesitated, then erased with the sleeve of his robe.
You do not believe that the returned are divine.
I thought we already talked about this.
We did. However, I realize now that this is the reason why you treat me as you do. You are different because you do not believe in my godhood. Is that the only reason
I find you interesting? And if you do not believe, it makes me sad. Because a god is who I am. It is what I am. And if you do not believe in it, it makes me think you do not understand me.
He paused.
Yes, it does sound petulant. I am sorry.
She smiled, then tentatively touched his arm. He froze, looking down, but didn't pull back as he had times before. So she moved up beside him, resting against his arm.
I don't have to believe in you to understand you, she said. I'd say that those people who worship you are the ones who don't understand. They can't get close to you, see who you really are. They're too focused on the aura and the divinity.
He didn't respond.
And, she said, I'm not different just because I don't believe in you. There are a lot of people in the palace who don't believe. Blue fingers, some of the serving girls who wear brown, other scribes. They serve you just as reverently as the priests. I'm just, well, I'm an irreverent type. I didn't really listen to my father or the monks back home either. Maybe that's what you need. Someone who would be willing to look beyond your godhood and just get to know you.
He nodded slowly. That is comforting, he wrote. Though it is very strange to be a god whose wife does not believe in him.
Wife, she thought. Sometimes that was tough to remember. Well, she said, I should think it would do every man good to have a wife who isn't in awe of him as everyone else is. Somebody has to keep you humble.
Humility is, I believe, somewhat opposite to godhood.
Like sweetness? She asked.
He chuckled.
Yes, just like that.
He put the board down. Then, hesitantly, a little frightened, he put his arm around her shoulders, pulling her closer as they looked out the window at the lights of a city that remained colorful, even at night. Bodies, four of them. They all lay dead on the ground. Blood, an oddly dark color, against the grass. It was the day after Vivenna's visit to the Dedenier garden to meet with the forgers. She was back again. Sunlight streamed down, hot upon her head and neck as she stood with the rest of the gawking crowd. The silent Dedenier waited in rows behind her, soldiers of stone who would never march. Only they had seen the four men die. People chattered with hushed voices, waiting for the city guard to finish their inspection. Denth had brought Vivenna quickly, before the bodies could be cleared. He had done so at her request. Now she wished she'd never asked. To her enhanced eyes, the colors of the blood on grass were powerfully distinct. Red and green. It made almost a violet in combination. She stared at the corpses, feeling an odd sense of disconnection. Color. So strange to see the colors of skin paled. She could tell the difference, the intrinsic difference, between skin that was alive and skin that was dead. Dead skin was 10 shades whiter than live skin. It was caused by blood seeping down and out of the veins. Almost like the blood was the color, drained out of its casks, the paint of a human life which had been carelessly spilled, leaving the canvas blank.
She looked away.
You see it?
Dent said at her side. She nodded silently.
You asked about him.